Welcome to Broken Law, brought to you by the American Constitution Society, a 501c3 nonprofit nonpartisan organization. I'm Beth Binchuk, Director of Policy and Program here at ACS. Since the Supreme Court released its decision in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health nearly 2 years ago, the laws surrounding abortion access have been chaotically changing. Anti-choice advocates have continued to seek greater restrictions and outright bans on abortion, turning to courts and legislatures to roll back reproductive rights even further. And in many states, pro-choice advocates have successfully turned directly to voters to enshrine the right to abortion into state constitutions. Today, we're going to discuss the latest happenings at both the state and federal levels. To help sort through all of this is Lindsay Langholz, Senior Director of Policy and Program here at ACS. She's a regular host of Broken Law and covers our abortion and democracy portfolios. Lindsay, let's dive right in. There's so much to cover.
Let's do it.
Let's start with the big news last week out of Arizona. What happened there?
So in Arizona, the Arizona Supreme Court, in a 4-2 decision, said that an 1864 law is now enforceable, which will have the practical effect of making abortion nearly a total ban on abortion, I should say. And in doing so, it's wild. Like, basically, I don't know how to describe what happened in this decision in Arizona other than, like, it is wild that in the wake of Dobbs, which opened the door to so much chaos that we're seeing in so many states, that this argument carried the day in Arizona. And it's worth remembering that in 1864, Arizona was a territory.
Not a state.
It was not a state. I think that we all know that at that point, women and people of color could not vote. In fact, the Civil War was being fought. So just to give a context.
I'd have to imagine medical practices were a little different back then.
Yes. You know, no one was going in for a sonogram in 1864. And so the only exception that the law now provides for in Arizona is to save a woman's life. So that is all. And if you think about it, it makes some sense because the 15-week, 6-week heartbeat bills all came about because of medical developments, right? Like, yes, they in 1864 decided that they were not going to allow for abortion with the exception of saving a woman's life. And it talk about rolling back the clock. This is the most extreme version that we've seen of this so far. And, you know, I was reading the X Twitter, I refuse to call it X, the Twitter feed of a colleague who was saying, you know, their work in Massachusetts to try and get one of these laws, these dormant laws off the books, there was laughed at when they came in the room and said, like, hey, we're trying to get this repealed. And they were told, like, well, why? It doesn't matter. These things, you know, like, we've moved on. And I think the folks of Arizona can tell you why these matter right now. It is wild that the pregnant people of Arizona in 2024 are going to be regulated by the voters of 1864. And I'm encouraged by the fact that Arizona voters are going to have an opportunity to weigh in November. There is a ballot initiative there that will put in place constitutional protections for abortion should they pass. But that's several months from now. We're also seeing the governor and state attorney general come out and say, like, their guidance does not change. They are not going to prosecute, even though the Supreme Court came out in this way. But it just introduces so much chaos for people who are just trying to seek care and just trying to get the health care that they need. They now have to try and figure out, okay, and providers too, right? Providers could, under this law that is now put into effect in Arizona, be prosecuted for providing abortions, except for in the very, very small exception that this 1864 law provides. So a lot of chaos in Arizona now unleashed that was predictable when the Dobbs decision came down. You know, the majority opinion in Dobbs and some of the concurrences, Justice Kavanaugh and others, tried to make it seem like we're just returning this to the voters in the states. You know, the Supreme Court's going to get out of this game. We shouldn't have been in this game deciding abortion rights and not. We're going to send this back to voters in the state and they can weigh in. And what we're seeing right now, at least in April of 2024, is that the voters of 1864 are getting to weigh in on the medical care of Arizona residents. And it just feels like we're living in the upside down. Like, how is this possibly the way that our laws are working?
And Arizona is not the only state with a big abortion decision coming from its state court. Could you tell us about what happened in Florida?
Yeah, never to be outdone. Florida also decided to weigh in. I should note that both states, after the Dobbs decision, put in place 15-week bans. So after the 15-week part, you could not get abortion care with very limited exceptions in those states. And Florida also took the extra step of putting in place a 6-week ban. So we've seen this in several other states. It's worth reminding that 6 weeks, most people don't know that they're pregnant. It is not something that is on your mind. It's certainly not something that is on many people's mind to check and see if they're pregnant and then access the care that they need within that clock,
right,
of an already stressed medical system. It's nearly impossible to get abortion care within the 6-week window.
Yeah. My understanding is how you count pregnancy, you know, the time from which you start. It's not necessarily intuitive that it starts before a missed period. And so it's a short time frame.
Yeah. It's really short. And I think that sometimes when people hear like 6 weeks, they think like, oh, 6 weeks after I know that I'm pregnant, or 6 weeks after I miss a period. And that is so far down the road.
In reality, not how that works.
No, you've well blown past the time frame if you're hitting 6 weeks after your missed period. What we've seen in the wake of Dobbs is so many structures in these states are underwater. You know, they're trying to provide as much care as they can. They're taking in patients from other states. And Florida was one of these states where they are doing their best to provide resources to not only Florida residents, but people throughout the South who were coming and seeking abortion care. So what was going on in the Florida case is the Florida Supreme Court looked at the 15-week ban, and they determined that the privacy protections in the Florida state constitution do not extend to abortion rights. In doing so, they've essentially also triggered, or however you want to phrase it, a law that had been dormant, that's a 6-week ban there, because it was written in such a way that it now comes into effect given the Supreme Court's action. So Florida is going to go to a 6-week ban, which is a near total ban for all practices and purposes. It's a ban. And those same people are going to have to go to North Carolina, Virginia. They're going to have to travel even further away. And if it's someone who's, for example, trying to travel to North Carolina, there's a 72-hour waiting period. So it's a significant amount of time investment that a lot of people can't make. And abortion funds are doing everything that they can to get people the care that they need. But it is similar to Arizona, it's now going to throw so much chaos into an already chaotic situation. But the other thing that came out of Florida, so two things actually came out of Florida in the very recent past, and that is that the Supreme Court did approve ballot language for an amendment to be put before the voters in Florida this November that would enshrine constitutional protection for abortion. So essentially, they interpreted the Constitution in the first decision and then said, you can amend the Constitution and essentially kind of override what we just came out with. So Florida voters will also get their opportunity to weigh in and provide better protections for people in the state. But again, it's going to be months before that happens. And there's so many people that need that care in the meantime. And it's not a given, you know? And so more than anything, I'll take the opportunity to say, please, please check what's on your ballot in November and vote abortion all the way up and down. But in the interim, there's going to be a lot of people who are going to be forced to overcome even more significant barriers to get the care they need.
And in every state where an abortion ban has taken effect, do voters get a say in whether they keep the ban or change the law?
Sadly, no, but a lot of states do. A lot of states do have a ballot initiative process or another direct democracy process where citizens can initiate a measure that's put before the voters, and it creates that direct democracy that the voters can weigh in. Unfortunately, not every state has that procedure. And sometimes it's through really weird ways. So
out of Mississippi, we just learned that they are not going to successfully have a ballot initiative put on the ballot.
It's kind of a complicated reason why. I will do my best to give the CliffsNotes version, which is the state constitution, which was amended in the 90s, requires that you collect signatures in all 5 congressional districts. And since the 90s, Mississippi has lost a congressional district through reapportionment. And so in 2021, the Mississippi Supreme Court came out and said, well, then you can't do initiatives. Sorry, if that's the constitutional language, then there just are no citizen-led initiatives. And so it would require dealing with reconciling that problem, which we have now passed the deadline to be able to do that for this election cycle. So Mississippi will not be able to fix the mess that they're in. And Louisiana Republicans in the state legislature, they're also recently just shut the door on an initiative to put before their voters. And so, yes, we are seeing in several states really great wins that you maybe wouldn't expect. I know we've talked on the podcast before about Kansas and about Kentucky, about some of these, like, not even purple states, like Kansas is a red state, but they were able to keep constitutional protections there for abortion. But it's not true in every state. And in the states where it is true, we're seeing attacks. We saw it in Ohio this past year where through some kind of trickery, I don't know how to describe it, shenanigans, they saw that an abortion ballot initiative was going to be on the ballot. And so state officials, including the Secretary of State, tried to end run around it and raise the bar for citizen run initiatives before they could get to that place. That failed, which was great to see. Ohio voters came out in droves to reject that legal shenanigan. But at the end of the day, what we are seeing across the board is popular ballot initiatives, particularly when it comes to abortion rights, and conservative legislators who are doing everything in their power to keep that question being put directly before the voters.
You're listening to Broken Law, brought to you by the American Constitution Society. If you're enjoying Broken Law, consider becoming a member of ACS today. You do not need to be a lawyer to be a member. As we discuss so often on this podcast, our laws and legal systems impact all of us. By supporting ACS, you support Broken Law, our work to diversify the federal bench, and our advocacy for Supreme Court reform. You also become a member of our nationwide network. Learn more about ACS by visiting our website at acslaw.org. And now, back to the conversation.
In the background of all of this state action is the U.S. Supreme Court. Let's start with the first of 2 abortion cases they'll be hearing this term. How did the oral argument go in FDA versus Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine?
You know, I think a lot of us braced for the worst going into those oral argument. And mercifully, I don't think that there are enough justices there who are willing to throw literal all rules to the wind and say, this is the result we want, which we didn't know. I mean, coming out of Dobbs, I think that we were all very skeptical about this court and the way that it often finds itself with a result that it wants and then kind of backends its way into getting there. But we did see an oral argument, a number of questions really focusing on a standing question. And so to explain that a bit, the group of people who brought this challenge to mifepristone, which is one of 2 medications used in medication abortion, which is the most common form of abortion in the country. What we saw with this challenge to the 20-year-old approval that the FDA gave was a group of people seeking out a judge in Texas to give them the result they wanted. And then the Fifth Circuit, who's incredibly conservative in their composition, not even being willing to go as far as the district court judges, but still willing to pull some restrictions back into place and really question the FDA's judgment. We saw this group of people get all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court at least have to wrestle with the question of whether or not they should be able to. This is a group of doctors, not all doctors who would in any way have to deal with abortion. There's a dentist in the group and a couple of organizations, which are not headquartered in Texas, come before the courts and say, we want there to be a national pulling of mifepristone from the shelves based on the fact that we don't like it, is essentially what they went before the court and said. And so we saw an oral argument, a ton of questions about what the actual harm is to this group of people. And you saw some of the justices say, like, I'm not seeing it in the record. Can you at least even give me a speculative harm? Like, what possibly is the harm that could come to particularly the physicians involved? And the best that we heard was, we might at some point have to treat a patient who took mifepristone and had complications. And in providing them care, we would be aiding and abetting an abortion, which we don't agree with. And you saw a number of the justices try and tease out what the difference is there between that and the conscious objections that are already provided for in law.
And there's not great answers there. So I was encouraged to hear skepticism from a number of the justices that this case should be before the court, that this group of people can second guess the FDA, or that judges should be in a position to weigh in on that particular question. There were some troubling things that came up in oral argument. I think I'm really concerned about the number of times that the Comstock Act was brought up. And for those who aren't in the weeds, this is an 1873 act. So, you know, so much more recent than the Arizona law. But an 1873 act that prohibits the mailing of immoral materials, which it includes in that description, all sorts of implements, but also promotional materials for abortion. The complication that would be for anybody trying to enforce the Comstock Act is, like, people use scalpels in certain procedures. Are you going to just ban all scalpels? Like, it's so impractical.
Where do you draw that line?
Yeah, it's so impractical for the modern world in which we live. And there's a reason that it hasn't been implemented in decades and decades. The number one reason was obviously because abortion was legal in every state because of Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey. But it's also just a mess. Like, it would be so difficult to try and navigate. And you saw Justice Alito try to really give some legitimacy to this law, which he would not refer to by name. He would refer to by the code section. But at the same time, out of the other side of his mouth, say, this is a really important and foundational law. I don't understand why the FDA wasn't wrestling with it, which is not a fair characterization of the Comstock Act by any definition that is operating in good faith. And so it was troubling to hear how many times both he and Justice Thomas brought the Comstock Act up and tried to really drill down on those questions. But I was encouraged that there didn't seem to be a ton of appetite from other justices to engage in this particular conversation on that. So I'm hopeful that we get a good result out of FDA. We never know with this court who wants to bank on this particular set of people upholding access to abortion care. But there did seem to be real skepticism about this group of plaintiffs bringing these claims.
And next week, the court will be hearing oral argument in Moyle. What's that issue in that case?
Moyle is a case that comes out of Idaho, and it is another case where both the parties and also some of the judges involved are trying to second guess medical expertise, but it's stirred different. So in Moyle, it's actually a couple of cases that have been consolidated, but at its core, there is a conflict between the state of Idaho and the federal government. And the federal government is trying to enforce a law that is shortened to EMTALA. It is an emergency medicine law that says that you have to provide stabilizing care, including to pregnant people, if you are a hospital or medical facility that accepts Medicare money. And the state of Idaho has, in the wake of Dobbs, passed a near total abortion ban. And while the federal government is trying to enforce EMTALA, objects and says, you cannot force the people of Idaho to stand by while you sneak in these abortions under this federal law, essentially, is their argument. It brings up questions of preemption, whether or not the federal law preempts the state law. So whether or not this law that says that you must provide the stabilizing care in an emergency situation preempts the abortion ban. It also brings up something from your field, which is a major questions objection, which I think you would actually do a much better job explaining than me, because this is more in your wheelhouse. The state of Idaho has raised this objection, so maybe you wouldn't mind explaining how that works.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So I'll be listening to hear how the justices respond to the invocation of the major questions doctrine. I'll, say at the front, I'm generally critical of the major questions doctrine. I take the view that it allows the court to appoint itself as a policy decision maker. But I have some more specific concerns about how the doctrine in Moyle could be coming up. So for background, the major questions doctrine has been described as applying in extraordinary cases where an agency is making decisions of vast economic and political significance. However, in Moyle, I think this is more of an issue of statutory interpretation. So whether EMTALA itself requires hospitals to offer abortion when that care is required to stabilize an emergency medical condition. So applying the major questions doctrine to Moyle would extend that doctrine's reach. And my concern is that this would just increase the court's ability to impose its own ideas about policy, really at the expense of Congress's choices.
Yeah.
The court, if there's a theme in the last several years, it has been just broadening its own power. And we saw that in Dobbs too, right? In Dobbs, it was, we don't care about precedent anymore. Stare decisis who? We don't know her. And really just inserting its own policy judgments. It's the animating fear behind the Mifepristone case is that the court will substitute its judgment for the FDA, which is a terrifying idea. The FDA regulates how all of the drugs and medicines that we use are put out into the market. And so the idea that 9 justices with 0 medical background are going to insert their own judgment would be troubling. That feels like an understatement.
Yeah.
I can't think of the right word to
absolutely
implicate the scale of concern. But here too, right? I think here, if they were to go down this path and say, yes, this is a major question, and to be clear about what they would be saying, they would say Congress didn't use the word abortion in EMTALA. And if you're going to make this political calculation that states have to do this, then you should say it explicitly. That's my understanding of that argument.
Yeah, it's really troubling, because if that's the route you wind up going down, does Congress now need to list out every, medical procedure that could conceivably be stabilizing care for an emergency medical condition?
Right.
And, wouldn't you rather have a healthcare professional be making those choices? Practically, I don't know how this could be done. It's scary.
Yeah. The core of what they're debating in the Moyle case in particular is, how sick does someone have to be before they can get one of these exemptions to these abortion bans? And so, in a state like now, unfortunately, if the Arizona law is enforced, where the only exception is to the life of the mother or other pregnant person, but in 1864, they weren't quite as gender inclusive. But if we have a near total ban where the only exception is life of the pregnant person,
right?
Then medical professionals we've seen this in Texas and other states, are put in the position of waiting to determine, okay, now it's not just an emergency situation. Now it's not just a stabilizing situation. Now it's the life. And you're seeing people go into sepsis. You're seeing people end up with enormous complications if their life is saved to endanger their actual fertility, which is, you would think, beside the point of what these people are trying to accomplish, but that does not seem to be a concern. And it's such a horrific question to be asking. Are you sick enough that we can give you the health care that we as medical professionals have determined that you need? Or do we have to wait a little longer and make sure that your life is imperiled? And that's really what's at the core of this case, is just how sick does someone have to be to get to avail themselves of the situation or the exemption, and for their medical providers to be able to do so and to give the care that's needed.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. This case, you know, isn't asking, you know, does EMTALA make abortion legal generally? It's asking, you know, in the very limited situations where EMTALA would be applicable, where there's an emergency medical condition and an abortion would be stabilizing care, does that provide a federal floor?
And what, I mean, how low is that floor, right?
Exactly.
Many people in the movement, myself included, have said before, like, Roe is a floor. Roe is a floor because Roe was providing just access. But man, if Roe is the floor, the bar is in hell for EMTALA. And still states are objecting and saying, no, we want to get in the, we want to get in between the pregnant person and their doctor and say, not yet. You've not put yourself enough in danger,
yeah,
to get this care. It's horrific.
In that oral argument, there'll just be a lot to be listening for. Considering all the things that are going on in this space, is there anything else that you're keeping your eye on right now?
You know, a big theme that has emerged that I think is worth keeping an eye on is that in all the stories we've already talked about, abortion is incredibly popular. Access to abortion is incredibly popular. There was a recent poll from Axios that said 81% of Americans believe that the government shouldn't get in between a pregnant person and their doctor in making these decisions. And yet, we're seeing conservative legislators, judicial officers, and others find any way possible to keep abortion bans in place or enact abortion bans and not allow voters to weigh in. Because we've seen time and time again that voters are in favor of measures that expand access and rights to abortion. And they're finding these 19th century laws, they're finding technicalities in state constitutional law that are obvious, easy to understand, and they're throwing their heels down and saying no. But at the same time, they understand the political implications of these issues. So you're seeing conservative lawmakers and candidates throughout the country hide from what they're doing. They want to keep doing it, but they want to not get penalized by voters when they do it. So you see former President Trump come out and say, oh, we're just returning it to the states. I don't know. But at the same time, a year ago, he was like, I am the one who overturned Roe versus Wade. I did it. That was me. You're seeing Senator Rick Scott in Florida come out and say, like, oh, I don't know. I think that maybe they went a little too far with this decision out of the Florida Supreme Court. But at the same time, not doing anything to reverse it. And we saw in Arizona, conservative lawmakers very quickly shut down argument about even trying to repeal the 1864 law, while at the same time seeing Arizona lawmakers say, like, oh, I don't know, I think it went too far. So they're trying to have their cake and eat it too. They're trying to eat their cake and have it too. I know, I'll never remember which way it is, but the correct way. And it's so cynical. You know, it is obvious that people do not want these bans. They do not want these restrictions. They find them to be reprehensible. And at the same time, they are not empowered in many places to undo these laws or to hold the folks accountable who are putting these bans in place. I'm really hopeful about the ballot initiatives we're going to see in Arizona and in Florida and in several other states. They are not the only states this year. But I think that if we're going to really tackle this problem, we have to understand the ways in which the erosion to democracy goes hand in hand with the erosion to reproductive rights. And it's a complicated conversation because it requires pulling in a lot of different things, right? It's like, it's not easy to message because you have to start talking about redistricting and how that impacts state legislatures and ballot initiative processes. And it's complicated, but I think it's worth understanding and getting right, because at the end of the day, rights are being rolled back to literally 19th century levels, and we're being gaslit as it happens by the Sam Alitos of the world who want to say, we're just returning this to the state so the voters can weigh in. Or the Rick Scotts who want to hide and say like, oh, no, this is too far. While doing everything in their powers for 50 years to put us in this situation. And so one thing that I am keeping an eye on this year, it's an election year for not only president, but all the way down the ballot. And so keeping an eye on any initiative that is on your ballot, but also the folks who are making your laws, whether that's at the local level, all the way up. And I think accountability is at the front of my mind when I read stories like Arizona. We didn't get into it, and it's more than we'll have time for in this particular podcast, but the way that Arizona was even able to be in the position they're in is because the court was expanded to put more conservatives on the court in recent years, which now allowed them to have a 4-2 decision, whereas before it probably would have been a split. And so it is a systems problem that we have, and one law, one person isn't going to solve the issue, but I think that it's really important for us in an election year to look at every single person that's on the ballot and figure out how to vote abortion up and down.
Well, Lindsay, thank you so much for joining today.
Thank you so much. This was so fun. It's always fun to be on this side of the microphone, and I'm so grateful to get to chat with you.
And thanks to our listeners for finding Broken Law. Please be sure to follow and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. If you're enjoying the show, help us bring it to more listeners by giving us a 5-star review and recommending Broken Law to a friend. If you have ideas for future episodes, let us know. You can email us at podcast@acslaw.org or find us on social media at @acslaw. Together, we'll speak truth to power about the law, whose interests it really serves, and whose it does not.